Good morning. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Keith Gaddy. Another spring has come and gone, and with the passing of spring, so too ends the 54th Oklahoma Legislature, which adjourned sine die. Now that the dust has settled at 23rd and Lincoln, those of us who survived, lawmakers, journalists, lobbyists, and the public, are left to figure out what the legislature did and did not do as we head into primary election season. To help us sort through the metaphoric and actual rubble surrounding the state capitol with the end of the session are Scott Carter, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Journal Record newspaper.
Good morning.
Sean Ashley, the news director of eCapitol.
Good morning.
And a familiar voice from State Impact Oklahoma team, Logan Layden.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when we get to the end of a project, we want to assess success and failure. Now, Scott Carter, you already issued some preliminary grades for the legislature in your fourth reading column of May 29th. Overall, how would you grade this session? Did the lawmakers succeed, or do they need to come back for summer school?
Oh, I don't want them to come back for summer school. No. And they have too much to do. They have campaigns to get out there and thump the tub about. So I pray that they don't come back. There were some things they did pretty well. There were a lot of things they left on the table. And there were some things that obviously I and several others disagreed with. But overall, it was one of the more contentious sessions I've seen in a long time. It was very rocky. It was very uneven. Some of that may have been because leadership was changing in the House, and that's to be expected. But if I was going to give the session as a whole a grade, it would probably be in the low C's, borderline.
Sean, what's your take?
Well, I may not have such a dark view, perhaps, of what happened this year. But I would say it's also not terribly well lit either. I look back at the start of the legislative session, and when you look at the executive budget that the governor put out, and when you look at what legislative leaders were talking about at the time, I would say they were far short of offering much excitement for us to look forward to. There were things we had heard in the past, such as proposals for an individual income tax cut, renewed efforts to try to fund repairs to the state capitol building, efforts to fund the American Indian Cultural Center, and a lot of stuff that we had heard before, and then proposals for a relatively flat budget for the coming year. So it wasn't like the trailer for the film was that exciting. And when you watch the film lived up to the trailer.
Well, Sean, just to remind everybody, if we go back and we look at the beginning of the session, the governor attempted to give us a preview, but it was a bit coy. Let's go back and listen to what she had to say at the time.
Well, you will see in my budget and in my State of the State speech a tax cut for Oklahoma, and you'll have to come to find out what it is and what the budget will be. But I do believe, and I've always believed, that keeping our taxes low, but yet providing for essential services of our state, is an important goal for the state of Oklahoma.
So, Sean, what did she propose? What did they try and get?
Well, ultimately, what they tried to do was fix a problem that they created last year on the individual income tax front. An individual income tax cut approved in the 2013 session, along with some other funding mechanism for repairs to the Capitol, was found unconstitutional. So that eliminated that tax cut, and they had to come back and try to fix that this year. When they looked at providing funding for core services, basically they funded them at levels equal to or lower than they had for the current fiscal year. So again, it was a movie where when you looked at the trailer, it wasn't that terribly exciting. And when the dust settled at the end of May, yeah, you were wondering what was better, the juju beans or the movie itself.
So overall, they got the remedial work done, but beyond that,
they did what they had to do.
Now, Logan, what's your all's take from over at State Impact?
Well, you know, as you know, we at State Impact, we focus a lot more on these kind of natural resources, water issues, mining issues. And if I was going to try to grade the legislature on those aspects this session, I'd have to give them like an incomplete. There just wasn't a whole lot of progress on some of these issues, which, you know, when you talk about things like water infrastructure, it's a multi-billion dollar problem in Oklahoma. So something like the Drought-Proof Communities Act, which would have ended up allowing small towns to get, you know, more money to fix some of their 100-year-old pipes and things, you know, would have helped a little bit. But, you know, it stalled out. There just wasn't a lot of movement on a lot of the things that we follow. So I'll give them an I for now. We'll see what they do next year.
So we have a low C, an incomplete, and did you like the Jujubes? Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. Now, Sean, if we could return to the budget for a minute. You've always been our go-to guy on budget issues. And the one thing that we had talked about back in February at the beginning of the session was that there was a lot of confusion about what would be done with the budget, that the governor was proposing tax cuts. But if we looked at the commitments the legislature was talking about making or even the programs the governor ended up wanting in her State of the State address, it was going to be a very difficult thing to reconcile spending with appropriations and also with the long-term commitments the legislature had already made. What do we make out of this budget? What is this? Are we making this up as we go along now? Or?
Well, I'm not sure it's fair to say that because it is a rather interesting approach. As you mentioned, there are a lot of commitments, there are a lot of needs, and the governor proposed some funding for some new programs. And in order to implement the tax cut that they previously tried to have, they went to the future. The tax cut does not take effect until January of 2016, but then it is dependent upon an increase in revenue. In other words, hopefully the tax cut won't cost the state any money because it will have been offset by increases in revenue collections. So that addresses both sides of the equation you mentioned, lowering the revenue with the tax cut but facing the existing costs, the new programs, and the other needs of the state. Much like I said a minute ago, when you look at the final budget itself, it appears on the surface that it reduces spending compared to the current fiscal year. But you've got to, again, look at the math at how they did that. Rather than increasing budgets for most state agencies for the upcoming fiscal year, a number of state agencies received what they called supplemental funding for the current fiscal year. That's additional money that they're giving them for now. Most of that money is not going to be spent by the end of this month, the end of June, the end of the fiscal year. So indirectly, they increase their budget for next fiscal year by putting a little extra money in their pocket now. Of course, it doesn't look that way on paper, so they can say they cut next year's budget. But state agencies that did receive that additional money will go into the next fiscal year with a little cash in their pocket.
So it's carryover funding, basically.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Scott Carter, let me ask you then, building on this, you know, budgets are where politics are determined, right? Who wins and loses in this budget? I mean, we came in, higher ed came in looking at a 5% cut. And we ended up not getting cut. Common Ed was coming in asking for an increase. Who won and who lost?
Well, I education at Common Ed won a little. I don't think they won that much. Higher Ed, I think, actually lost, even though their budget was standstill. They're like career tech. A standstill budget works in a vacuum, but it doesn't take into account that the cost that any agency faces, goods and services, those always increase. The rest of the world doesn't stand still. The rest of the world goes on. And so those costs grow, and you have, with a standstill budget, less money to spend before it's all said and done. Common Ed, half of the $80 million that the legislature is trumpeting is going to cover health care costs. Already half, and then another $25 million is ad valorem reimbursement from last year. So I don't see that much. They did put a little new money in Common Ed. Speaker Scott Inman talked about I think he ran some numbers and said it's about $9 a student, and that's it. That's it. That it's not a big win, but it's better than the alternative.
Well, Scott, if I can follow up on this for a moment, and any of you should feel free to chime in on this. Who's taking the big hit in this budget? Who are the losers in this budget?
52 state agencies.
I think that's probably
take a little one. Take OETA. OETA is a little state agency. It's got a budget of about at one time its budget was about $5 million. Now it's about $3.6 million. They're taking a 5.5% cut. There's nowhere to cut at OETA, really. I mean, granted, they can make up some of that money with their foundation and stuff like that, but it's like the Historical Society. You've got the bunch of little agencies that their budgets are under, you know, $10 million bucks. a year, and the cuts are much bigger for these smaller agencies than it is for somebody like higher ed or somebody or common ed or the health department or something like that. It seems to affect them much greater. So, and I think that's how the part of the mechanism for balancing the budget was on the little bitty state agencies.
And we heard back when the governor's budget was unveiled and it called for largely across the board cuts, some of these smaller agencies, like Scott mentioned, have had cuts in previous years. So they have found ways to reduce the cost of their operations, but they're running out of ways to do that. There's only so much less paper you can buy, so many fewer people you can have on the job. Now, at the time, however, Secretary of Finance Preston Dorflinger said, well, as I look around my agency, the Office of Management and Enterprise Services, I see that you know, we can absorb that kind of cut. So, you know, any agency worth its salt should be able to do that. But it has been year after year after year, and I believe some agency heads and some agency personnel are getting frustrated. They don't see an end to these cuts, and they don't see how much further some place like OETA can cut. And keep in mind, the single largest cost for all of state government is personnel. It's their salaries and it's their benefits. And you reach a point when you've eliminated all the paper in the office that then you have to start looking at eliminating people, and eliminating people affects programs.
Well, then, you know, obviously, yes, just like they said, the state agencies are losers, and they, you know, that's obviously a trend over the last several years. But some of the smaller agencies that we've talked to, they're happy to even still be around at this point. You know, if you go back to the beginning of the session, I think the Scenic Rivers Commission is the example I'm thinking of. You know, there was an attempt to make it no longer in its current form.
Yeah, they were going to try to roll that into tourism with the Arts Council and the Historical Society.
So I think, you know, at least there are some people within maybe those agencies who aren't completely upset. So,
well, you know, at the beginning of the session, one of the things that we had discussed, something that was prompted in the governor's State of the State address, was the need to attempt to reorganize or eliminate many of these boards and commissions that are involved with many of these state agencies. And of course, you know, attention has been drawn to this most dramatically due to the issues over at State Corrections. One thing we had speculated about was whether or not the governor could find real savings through consolidation of agencies, boards, and commissions. And that seemed like the great opportunity the governor might have. What happened?
Well, I give the governor more credit than most people would for that, because there is a need to get rid of some of those. There really are. And the governor needs, if you're going to be the chief executive, you need to have some executive control over some of the agencies that are under you. The War Veterans Commission is a beautiful example of that. What got lost, though, is in some of these agencies, take the Arts Council, they have their own independent board. But if you roll them under tourism and eliminate the Arts Council board, then you eliminate all the federal funding they get for arts programs. And I don't think that was all clearly explained to everybody when we got on the Let's Consolidate bandwagon, is some of these entities that were set up with their own separate board were done exactly for that reason, to capture federal money. When you get rid of them, you lose the federal funds too. And I don't think they wanted to do that. And so they had to back off and go, well, we're going to have to let this one exist, the Arts Council. They're going to have to let this one exist, or we lose the federal funds. So they're going to have to go back and really get away from conventional thinking and look at a different approach to continue this effort to consolidate. Again, part of that's probably a good idea. The governor deserves some credit for starting the discussion and trying to streamline some of the functions of state government. But they're going to have to take into consideration every revenue stream that flows into that agency, and I don't think that had always been done.
When the governor came into office, this is one of her key goals that she cited at the time. And actually in 2013, a piece of legislation passed that affected a number of boards and commissions within the health department. We used to have separate barber and cosmetology regulatory boards in the state of Oklahoma. And for years, efforts had been made to combine those. And finally, that was done, along with there were some 30 or more little boards and commissions that were housed under the health department that were either eliminated because they really weren't doing anything, or they were somehow consolidated into one another, like barbering and cosmetology. But I believe Scott is absolutely correct. You need to look at the big picture. and see where the opportunities for consolidation are and where there are those areas where there are federal funds involved or other regulatory issues like in some of the environmental areas that you can't effectively do that. We still have a tremendous number of boards and commissions. There is a board of chiropractic examiners. They have a staff of three. Yet they meet approximately every month and they hear complaints lodged against chiropractors within the state of Oklahoma. There are other small boards like that that perhaps somehow could be combined in some form or fashion, or you need the special focus. But that needs to be examined in the whole rather than sort of let's just grab these guys and put them here.
Yeah, you would think some of those, like especially on the health system, could be rolled under the Board of Medical Licensure. But then you start talking about that and the nurses want their own board. The chiropractors want their own board. The physicians want their own board.
Last year, there was an effort at this in the state legislature and we saw 5,000 nurses storm the state capitol to lobby.
Exactly.
You know, they happened to be in town in convention and they timed it just at the right time. And you know, this every one of these boards has a constituency.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and when you're talking about these small boards and agencies, I mean, some of it just seems like, at least from the outside, just, you know, complete waste, like Oklahoma's spaceport and the one guy that we have out there running the thing. It seems like, well, what do we – that seems just like total waste.
Well, and if you go back and really think about that, the whole issue with the spaceport and rocket plane and stuff like that, that's what spawned David Dank's huge investigation of all the tax incentives were – issues within that system right there. I mean, it seems to me there you want to get rid of an agency that's probably unnecessary. The spaceport system, find the guy a job over at transportation, but get the what are we doing?
Right. Yeah. When we went out there to interview, it's just a big empty airport landing strip that he maintains pretty much. Make sure the doors on the hangars are still working, right, you know, every right, other day, right. Things like that.
I'm not sure where else we would land a spaceship, but you know, at least we
well,
have
Well, according to Star Trek mythology, the Klingons were discovered in Broken Bow, Oklahoma, about 100 years from now in the future. So they may want to get prepared.
Well, I'm hoping to be around to greet them when they arrive.
Okay.
You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Keith Gaddy and Logan Layden from State Impact Team. Of the bills that you folks were watching over at State Impact, one was the horizontal drilling tax incentive. Now, this bill passed in the 11th hour of the legislative session. But this legislation has also attracted the critical eye of Oklahoma City Attorney Jerry Fent, the fourth branch of Oklahoma government of late. He's been very successful
yes.
in challenging the constitutionality of several conservative initiatives over the past several years. What is the horizontal drilling tax incentive? What was done to it? And what's the issue here?
Okay. Well, basically, yeah, just to break it down, the tax incentive was, and I think it goes back to 1994, so it was 1% on horizontally drilled wells. Now, the usual gross production tax on oil and gas is 7%. But for these horizontal wells, we put it at 1% to incentivize it. Back in the mid to late 90s, it wasn't that common of a practice. Now, pretty much every new well that's drilled is a horizontal well. And so this incentive, you know, these companies are only paying 1% for the first 4 years that the well is active. Then it jumps to 7%. But it's only really during that first few years that the well gives you anything. So 5-6 years down the road when it's 7%, we're not making a lot of money off that stay. So the attempt to change that came this year, you know, lobbying hard on both sides. Some oil executives that we talked to thought that, you know, it would be okay to let it go to 7%, that we drill for oil in Oklahoma because we have oil and gas in Oklahoma, not because the taxes are low. Others, you know, obviously oil and gas industry, some of our biggest companies said no, you know, we need this incentive. And so a kind of compromise was reached where it goes to 2% after the first 3 years of production for both horizontally drilled and regular vertical wells. So it seems like you're raising the tax by 1% here for the first few years of production, which would be an issue in the last days of the legislative session because you're not supposed to be able to do that thanks to State Question 640, which says on revenue bills, if you're raising revenue for the state, it can't happen in the last 5 days of the legislative session and you have to have 3/4 majority in the legislature or it has to go to a vote of the people. But now the question is this a violation of State Question 640? I talked to Attorney General Scott Pruitt yesterday, and you know his responsibility is going to be to defend this. You know, when Jerry Fent brings the case, he was basically saying he really takes it literally when you look at 640. This you can't raise revenue in the last few days of the legislature. Literally raise. So if you lower taxes, that's okay. Was the view that he was giving me here. So the question is then, well, it goes from 1% to 2%. It seems like a tax increase. But no, since the incentive doesn't go into effect until after the expiration of the old incentive, it's actually a cut from 7% to 2% is his position. So
Sean, that word raise, okay? There are two ways of thinking about that word when it comes to revenue, right? Now, what are they?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean, but there are a couple of ways that you can look at it. There is the direct comparison, like Logan was referring to. Are we going from 1% to 2%? And for that matter, are we also raising revenue by reducing the number of years that the incentive is available from 48 months to 36 months? And if you look at those aspects of it, again, it would appear that we are raising revenue. A key point Logan makes is that the current incentive does expire next year before the new one takes effect. So there are a number of issues that come into play there. And Mr. Fent, in his arguments on this bill, I believe, as well as on Senate Bill 1246, which was the individual income tax we spoke of earlier, is questioning whether State Question 640 actually said raise. His question relates to any revenue changes, whether it be an increase or a decrease. And so the court's going to have an interesting struggle there, I believe, to determine whether the voters of Oklahoma meant to say that lawmakers could not change state revenue collections at all without 75% approval in the legislature or a vote of the people, and certainly not during the last 5 days of the legislative session.
The interesting thing on that, though, and that's the only component of Fent's lawsuit that I think is weak. I think he's handed the court a good issue to chew on about revenue, because there hasn't been a direction from the court on what does that mean. And I think that's pretty solid. The thing, though, that I think it may trip him up, if anything trips him up, is this last 5 days of session, because the legislature adjourned early. Now, the Constitution requires them to get out by the last Friday in May, 90 legislative days. And the court's probably going to, at least I would hazard a guess, that the court would look at that 90 legislative days, the last week of session, would have been the last week in May and not the week that the legislature chose to adjourn. And I think that may trip him up.
That's it. I'd not even considered that point. Yeah.
But
there's always – Sean always has a trump card. That's why I never play cards with him.
On Wednesday of what ended up being the final week of the legislative session, the House passed a resolution saying they would adjourn on Friday prior to passing the gross production tax cut. The Senate passed that resolution on Thursday prior to passing the gross production tax cut. Okay. So they had established that they were going to adjourn on Friday, May 23rd.
So they may have boxed themselves into a corner.
They may have boxed themselves into a corner if the issue of the final 5 days of the legislative session is an important issue for the court in this
case. Well, and again, the court may have to point to the legislature and say, here's what the Constitution says. You guys, when you do that, that doesn't work. And they may. But I can see them having to scratch their heads to decide, because that's one of Fent's key arguments in this, is the last 5 days component. What does that really mean when you adjourn early?
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. And gentlemen, I'm just curious to hear what you think of this. This set of rules that they're operating under out of the state constitution were put into place originally as part of a set of conservative initiatives to amend the state constitution. These tax rules, term limits, for that matter, the Ethics Commission being constructed, all occurred at about the same time in Oklahoma and all precede this beginning of this during the Republican Party.
During the Bellman administration, second administration of Governor Bellman.
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. It's all taken place in roughly the same period of time. This this cage the legislature finds itself in was created by conservatives.
Yeah, go
to a small extent. And now they're discovering for the first time that they're having to try and govern in the cage that they created. I mean, in a sense, they seem to have been hoist on their own petard. Are there other
term limits?
Yeah, okay. So term limits is another trap sitting out there that this legislature has to deal with.
Well, and I think once term limits kicked in, I think every Republican legislature set back as a whole and looked and started scratching their heads about, well, I wonder if this is such a good idea after all. Because once – just about the time you really get the experience and you really get the understanding,
yeah,
you got to go.
And I guess what I'm getting at is there anything substantively wrong with the change in the horizontal drilling tax incentive? It does increase revenue, correct? It does lead to an increase in revenue for the state.
Well, the estimates from the Tax Commission for the first couple of years – indicated that there would probably be no change in revenue. When you looked further out, there was then a dispute between the House and the Senate, not a big dispute, but you had some members in the House saying that we would see a $26 million revenue increase, while in the Senate they were saying we don't know what it's going to be because it's too hard to calculate. That's another issue that may come into play in Mr. Fent's suit. Is the Tax Commission estimates, and go back to what Logan said a moment ago, we're talking about a new – what effectively is a change or a new incentive come July 1st, 2015. So we won't know. If we go to court later this year, we won't know what the impact of that is because the Tax Commission says it appears to have no impact. We don't have revenue collections actually to look at. So have we increased or decreased revenue?
Well, but it was done with the intent to increase revenue. And I think you're going to have to look at legislative intent. The court does that all the time.
They do.
And it was done because that there was, as Logan pointed out early, so many wells are now drilled horizontally. The incentive was unnecessary and it was a way to bump up revenue, whether it generates it in the first year or the second year or 3 years down the road. The intent, though, was to increase more money flowing into the general fund. And
yeah,
I think that's what the court's going to look at.
Yeah. I mean, if you read the text of, you know, State Question 640, which I happen to have right in front of me right now, that's, you know, that's exactly what it says. This any bill passed by the legislature intended to raise revenue for the support of state government. And it just seems on the surface, you look at this new law, this new incentive going from 1% to 2%, it seems clearly that it was intended to increase revenue to the state. But at the same time, it is. It's also you can look at it as a tax decrease meant to increase revenue for the state.
Keep in mind, that was done by that incentive was done by an Oklahoma City stockbroker named Dan Brown that came on the heels of House Bill 1017 in 1991, mm-hmm. I'm thinking. Was it one?
One.
One, yeah. And it was the backsplash over getting the education and tax hike bill passed was that. And that was – we were going to clamp down on the legislature to prevent them from raising taxes and without a vote of the people. Professor Gaddy's right. If you're going to write that rule and say any revenue-raising measure – and see, Fent has also – I've talked to Jerry on more than one occasion. He's talked about not only taxes but fees that would fall under that. He thinks if the legislature authorizes a fee increase that it still falls under 640 and is
– it's raising revenue for the state. Right. Yeah, it seems very obvious. Yeah.
Now, it remains to be seen whether or not the legislature made any other work for Jerry Fent during this session beyond the gross production tax. But Fent's activities and the activism of the Oklahoma judiciary brought the judiciary to the attention of the legislature. There was debate at the beginning of the session about changing judicial selection and retention. Then late in the session, after a decision from the state Supreme Court staying the execution of an inmate at the penitentiary in McAllister, which ended up becoming a highly controversial botched execution, which again, place the state of Oklahoma on the international radar for our capital punishment practices. Some lawmakers threatened impeachment and the removal of several judges. Has the judiciary gotten out of this session unscathed?
I don't think the judiciary is ever safe because of the awkward position they're put in. Although we talk about, you know, our three branches of government, our fourth when you include the media, and the fifth when you include Jerry Fent, I don't think they're ever safe because they're in an awkward position. While they interpret the laws, as we simply say, they also rely on the executive and the legislative branch for financing. They also rely on the executive and the legislative branch for sort of how they're able to operate, how they're selected. And we saw that selection process challenged this year in the legislature. But what ultimately happened was when changes were proposed to the committee that nominates judges for the governor's consideration were brought to the House floor, I have never seen so much red appear on the vote board immediately when the roll was opened. It was surprising to me that that bill was even on the floor, because the moment they said open the roll, there were like 30-some no votes for that bill, and then those no votes continued to grow.
If you wanted to see an absolutely textbook, stellar, beautiful example of hardcore lobbying, watching the Bar Association, who very rarely ventures to the Capitol other than to, you know, set in on the budget talks for the courts and stuff like that, the Bar Association stays quiet. And this year's Bar Association president, Renee DeMoss, went thermal on the legislature, and she tacked them to the wall. They came out in numbers, and they lobbied hard against that bill, and that's what killed it.
Oh, no doubt. The day the bill was up for consideration, you may recall, a large number of them were there outside the foyer to the House.
And what you didn't see was the action alerts that the Bar Association – the Bar Association has 16 or 17,000 members in the state. And they sent out these action alerts to every Republican Bar Association member from here to Pontotoc County and Guymon, saying call your lawmaker and tell them this is the bad idea. Now – you know, we can make all the lawyer jokes you want, but lawyers, when they get organized, are really, really effective at changing policy. And they did. And they put pressure on every lawmaker out there. And like Sean said, the board lit up red.
One of the issues that when we spoke during the session, we observed was that from time to time, legislation would come to the floor. We didn't understand why it came there, especially in the state house. We are on our sixth speaker in 9 years in the Oklahoma House of Representatives. Now, at the beginning of the session, we had discussed whether or not Tom Coburn's departure was going to affect the ability of the House to govern itself with the departure of T.W. Shannon to run for the U.S. Senate, and then the ascension of Jeff Hickman as Speaker of the House. Has the House been detrimentally affected by the departure of Speaker Shannon?
I'm not sure I would label it detrimentally affected. Anytime, as they say, anytime in any organization where you have change in leadership, there's going to be some fallout from that. And I think there was that, just the process of change. We saw Speaker Hickman replace some committee chairs. We saw him get rid of a committee that scheduled legislation on the floor, and a couple of things like that rankled some members, and some of them quite greatly. Representative Jason Murphy, for example, was very upset about elimination of the calendar committee. He challenged it in the rules committee. He challenged it in the calendar committee, and he challenged it again on the floor. But what I think you saw was Speaker Hickman trying, I hate to say impose his will, but to make the House his. And there were some bumps in the road in that process.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's detrimental. Jeff Hickman is a smart guy. He's very pragmatic, and he understands politics very well. It was that early learning curve, though, that was really, really bumpy. He was the polar opposite of Shannon. There was a lot of divisiveness because he ran against the Shannon when they ran. Shannon ran for Speaker the first go round. So the guy that lost ends up becoming the guy that wins the second time around. And there was some difficulty in the various camps on supporters of, you know, this group supported the Shannon team, this group supported the Hickman team. And there was some tension between those groups that I think probably took most of the session to at least get under control. I'm not going to say it went away because I don't think it has, but at least to get it under control. And it made the session rocky because the House was very, very emotional this year, unlike years previous. It was very emotional. It reacted quickly. At times I think it overreacted, and at times I don't think it moved quickly at all. So it made session difficult.
And I think you're always going to have, you know, Scott mentioned the camps. As the Republican caucus has grown, now it's 72 members, and any time you get that large, you're going to have some divisions within your body.
Sure.
And we've seen that over the years. And I think oftentimes much of the tension within the Republican caucus is more reflective of these different views that they have than simply who's in charge. You're never going to find someone everybody supports,
no,
I guess is my bottom line.
Agreed. And what you see is the advent of the modern Republican Party in Oklahoma because there are so many divergent views. This is their version of the big tent, and you have all these people under there, and there is going to be friction. That's to be expected. It just seemed extra coarse this year.
I would agree.
But they seem to, like you said, you know, kind of get it together toward the end. And I believe, you know, we've been talking about this oil and gas incentive, and if I recall correctly, that was one of Jeff Hickman's bills. And so this that he was out there arguing for, this incentive of 2%, is even less than what the oil and gas companies had proposed the year before. So, you know, he surely looks on that as a success.
You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm OU political science professor Keith Gaddy, joined by Logan Layden, who was just speaking to us, Sean Ashley and Scott Carter. Speaking of contentious issues, another contentious issue that had been holding up the House and the Senate and the governor was the repair bill for the state capitol. Now, I know you guys have been out there wearing hard hats, ducking falling rubble all session, both metaphorically and literally. But we thought this issue was resolved last year when the capital repair bill was rolled into the tax cut, which was thrown out by the state Supreme Court. Coming into this session, we thought that there was going to be tremendous resistance to any capital repair bill that wasn't a pay-as-you-go solution. The Senate wanted bonds. The governor wanted bonds. Speaker Shannon wanted a pay-as-you-go approach. The removal of the speaker, we speculated, might lead to a resolution. But even then, we found that this capital repair bill issue became controversial, contentious, and the House and the Senate were locked up on it. They could not come to an agreement. What prompted these lawmakers to finally come to a deal to save this crumbling edifice up there at 23rd and Lincoln?
The ceiling fell in the basement.
Yeah.
And it really did. It fell in the House staffer's office. I think that was the final straw that got him off high center was, you know, somebody could have been sitting there and got beamed upside the head by a piece of stray concrete.
That weighed about 3 pounds.
Yeah, which would have done serious damage.
And they waited till the absolute last moment that they could when the ceiling was crumbling and do it then. I mean, that's the option that they took. I mean, that's not going out on a limb waiting for the ceiling to start coming down before you actually fix the thing. So it didn't take a lot of political courage, it doesn't seem like, to get that done.
Well, I mean, do the walls have to continue to crumble and the ceilings continue to fall to get lawmakers to take action?
You know, I think there were a number of issues at play over the last couple of years on the House opposition in particular to funding repairs to the Capitol. First of all, there is the issue of bonds, of going into debt. There's a contingent within the House that opposes that, despite the fact that Oklahoma comparatively has very little debt.
And is paying off a great big hunk of it between now and 2018.
Exactly. Those same people also tend to frequently are in the same camp with Jerry Fent in arguing that any debt we do take on should go to a vote of the people. And we initially saw that in Speaker Hickman's proposal that the $120 million bond issue be put to a vote of the people rather than simply approved by the legislature. And then there are others that within that camp and within, I think, the entire House who are concerned about how such large projects will be managed and the money being spent. The final piece of legislation includes a legislative sort of oversight committee that will work with the tenants within the Capitol, the largest of whom are the legislature, of course, to sort of help develop these plans and work through what's going to happen to the building rather than just simply leaving it to the Office of Management and Enterprise Services and the architect and construction firm that they hire. They want some input into the process. And I think finally all of that came to a head, as Scott and Logan just said, you know, and they decided they needed to resolve the issue when part of the ceiling flopped down on a staff member's desk over the weekend.
Now, it appears we may finally have this issue fixed. But there are other lingering issues. There are other lingering disasters waiting to happen out there. One thing we're hearing is Western Oklahoma and the Panhandle are facing renewed drought, ongoing drought, and actually a reemerging dust bowl out in the Panhandle. This leads to an obvious question, and I direct this to Logan, which is, where are we on water?
Well, it's one of the biggest issues, maybe the biggest issue facing the state going forward for the next several decades. And just because it rained a lot over the last couple of weeks doesn't mean that, you know, out in Western Oklahoma, that the problem's solved. No, this is like the fourth year of drought that they're dealing with out there. And, you know, you've got lakes drying up. We covered the Canton Lake situation, which was when Oklahoma City needed water last year. They took it from Canton Lake, you know, northwest of the city. Only problem is it pretty much kills that town that's over there, you know, by the lake. And you go down to Altus and Lawton and all these communities in southwest Oklahoma where their lakes are, you know, just dropping constantly. And they're down to very dangerous levels now where we're getting to the point that, you know, you're not going to be able to use it even to provide water for your town. And so you've got lots of communities really desperately thinking of different ways that they can ensure that they have enough water for the next 40, 50 years. And the legislature didn't do a whole lot on it this year. There were several bills, but not many of them moved a long way. But one of the ones that did get all the way through and is pretty big deal for the state is this water reuse bill. This was pushed by lawmakers in Norman who would like to take the water that we use from Lake Thunderbird out here, use it, and then treat it again and put it back in the lake. This is something that kind of grosses people out a lot of times. This is wastewater. This is Norman's wastewater that we're going to be reusing. But, you know, as J.D. Strong at the Water Resources Board says, people are just going to have to get over that. This is the reality of the future. And the reality is El Reno dumps their wastewater and it ends up in Oklahoma City and we drink it up there anyway.
So think about the water table. I mean, every glass of water we drink or every cup of coffee or soda at some point was – 6,000-year-old dinosaur pee. So.
Right.
It's all being recycled.
Right. And it's becoming this would – if you tried to do this, you know, in the 90s, there'd be no way. But now just because of the situation, because of how bad the drought is, people are pretty easily, I think, able to get over. I don't run into a lot of people whenever I go talk to folks on the street and ask them about this that just go, oh, there's no way. No, that's not – no way would I ever drink that.
Now, no. Logan, does this open the door to what are called brown water systems?
Well, down the line, perhaps. I don't think that that's – I think that's a little bit further. You have to kind of take people step by step here, you know, before we start getting into, you know, brown water, brackish water, things like this.
Think of it like this. What you may see is gray water used for purposes that don't involve human consumption, watering your lawn, plants, stuff like that. You'll see industrial use. You may see a lot more use of that. You may see recycled wastewater used in a lot of areas that normally treated water that is potable for a community would be used for. Take that out of the equation, so you have to treat less water for.
Yeah. Use that for – if you're going to water your golf course, use that, not
well,
the drinking
and
water.
I know Oklahoma City is pushing – I got a flyer the other day, their water and garbage bill that you can buy rain barrels. And they're encouraging people to buy rain barrels and you set one up to water your lawn instead of using
There's no reason
the hose on it, right.
to use treated drinking water to do that.
To water your lawn. Absolutely. I think you're going to see a lot more communities do things like that to get at least a small handle on how the state deals with its water resources.
It's funny that you bring up local government, because here we have local governments being given increased latitude to do things, right? Yet the legislature has also stepped forward and said that local governments don't have latitude to do other things, like set a local minimum wage.
Well, water, even though it's political, it's not as hotly political as the minimum wage.
And people don't want, $200-$300 water bills in 10 or 15 years. So, there's a little bit of incentive there too.
Yes.
And Oklahoma has a weird, I don't know, history and current situation with so-called preemption laws, where the state says a local community can or can't do something. They can't set their own minimum wage, but they can determine now, as a result of a law passed in 2013, of whether there can be smoking in a park.
Right.
They can't state law prevents communities from having stricter gun laws than the state of Oklahoma, yet decisions regarding knives are left to the local community. And in fact, Governor Mary Fallon vetoed a bill this year because it would have imposed a regulation related to knives statewide. So while signing the minimum wage preemption law, she vetoed the knife preemption law.
And the absolutely huge example of that is storm shelters.
Yes.
We are going to kick it to the cities to decide on the safety of public school children. They don't want an overall state system of how to fund and construct storm shelters, so we'll kick that to the city. But at the same time, cities can't raise minimum wage. It's a real love-hate relationship with preemption.
Yeah. I will note that the state constitution prohibits the wearing of a non-ceremonial sword in public. So there is some state authority governing the wearing and use of blades.
We also set the flashpoint at kerosene too.
Yes. Yes, we do, because we've never had a constitutional revision, but we'll take that up in another show. Now, Governor Fallon has been throwing some vetoes around. There was a period of a few days midway through session where she threw, I think it was a total of 14 vetoes in less than 24 hours. And the argument at the time was that she was doing this in order to get the lawmakers to focus on the pressing problems confronting the state. Now, one of these vetoes dealt with third-grade reading standards and the promotion of students. The legislature had passed legislation placing the decision to promote in the hands of parents in consultation with schools, and the bill was then vetoed by the governor, and that veto was quickly and overwhelmingly overridden. Why did third-grade reading standards become such a hot-button issue?
Because they were looking at – the State Department of Ed was looking at – between 8,000 and 9,000 students that were going to be held back. And the public outcry was building. Pressure was really building on the legislature. And there were also complaints that the law as it stood was not being evenly enforced when it came to students who had disabilities, who had issues such as dyslexia or doing English as a second language and things like that. And the backlash pushed enough in the legislature to go back in and change. I mean, that was a bipartisan deal. You had guys like Mike Shelton working with guys like Paul Wesselhoff on that deal, because there was so much pressure just statewide to make a change.
And the timing was perfect. As Scott said, this bill began at the start of the legislative session. There was already concern, and it was working its way through the process. And then we learn 8,000 to 9,000 could not be promoted as a result of the single test, which was a concern for a number of legislators. As that bill was nearing sort of its final vote and then got vetoed, so you had sort of the perfect storm.
It's a good way to describe it. It was a perfect storm.
Our concern is these kids aren't going to get promoted. Oh look, here's a really big number. Oh look, here's a veto, and almost immediately, here's an override.
I was somewhat surprised that the governor vetoed this bill. And in fact, it points to a larger conflict the governor seems to have with the legislature, and also a place where the governor seems to be out of step with a good bit of public opinion in the state, which is these issues of education, especially in common ed. The governor has come out in favor of Common Core at the beginning of the session, despite a widespread public pushback, especially inside the Republican Party against Common Core, came out against this reform of third grade reading standards and then was decisively overwhelmed by the state legislature. And it's actually a problem that she shares with State Superintendent Janet Barisi. Are the third grade reading standards part of a larger dispute over Common Core, over who has control of public education in the state of Oklahoma? Where does this issue fit into the politics that the governor is going to run in this year?
There was more of a broad-based pushback on the reading test than I think there has been on Common Core. There was a very vocal group of residents who came to the Capitol. There were about 200 of them, all packing green shirts, that were anti-Common Core. And they had tied Common Core to everything from the president's health care plan to the United Nations. And there were some pretty strange analogies made there. But there is there has been for several years this growing frustration with state government on education mandates. You say you want us to have local control. We go back to this local control, local government versus state government fight. You say you want us to have local control, but yet you give us all these mandates still. And that frustration continues to grow. And it's not just led by parents now. That's why you saw 25,000 school teachers come to the Capitol, was they're really frustrated with the way the legislature – you could look at it the same way the federal government has approached tribal sovereignty. It's a seismograph. It goes up and down and it's all over the board. It's the same thing with education in Oklahoma. We haven't come up with a definitive plan. The last time we did was in 1991, and now, you know, about 20 years later, more than 20 years later, that plan's been shelved. We're trying something else.
I think what we're seeing is what's – I think we're far from ending the battle over education issues in Oklahoma. If you look at the Common Core issue, for example, that's one that was not only this session. It started at the end of the last session, went through interim studies last summer, and then grew bigger and bigger as this session went on. If you look at the reforms that the legislature has passed the last several years, there's concern about those among education officials at the local level, and particularly we're not getting funded to implement these, and you're sort of meddling. Now if we repeal Common Core, they're going to be setting standards at the state level and passing them down locally again. And then if you look at the very end of the legislative session, something that sort of slipped under the radar for most people, I think, was that the House Administrative Rules Committee in its omnibus rules resolution proposed disapproving some education standards in Oklahoma, in particular science standards. That bill didn't move forward, so when another rules bill, administrative rules bill, was heard in the Senate, Senator Anthony Sykes added disapproval of those rules to that measure. The measure ultimately didn't get passed, but he specifically said the concern was over some of the climate change information that was in the curriculum being proposed by the State Department of Education. So now we have Republican legislators who are at odds with the State Department of Education that is going to be setting the curriculum if we repeal Common Core. And then you have parents and teachers who are concerned, right, and community leaders who are concerned as well. That's a growing battle that, much like 1991 perhaps, will have to be fought all over again.
Well, we're chasing our tail because the legislature is reacting. You get draft legislation from the American Legislative Exchange Council. You get certain advocacy groups pushing against a policy that they see as federal takeover or something like that. And then state government reacts, and it reacts perhaps too quickly instead of really giving those the once over and trying to get everybody at the table to see whether or not it's necessary. And you have this, and we just keep going around in a circle.
But I think it's sort of like a snowball. It's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And at some point, a group of people or some strong-willed individual like a Governor Bellman is going to have to step in front of that snowball.
Well, and that's what it took Bellman doing that in the 90s to say, no, we're going – he formed, I think it was called Task Force 2000, if I remember right, and got everybody from across the spectrum together in a big room and said, we want your best ideas for education, rolled it into an education reform package, and despite people saying it wouldn't happen, got it through the legislature, got it passed into law. Yeah, it spawned a few other things, such as the 640 initiative. But for a long time, it had some pretty progressive things in it, such as lower classroom size and a focus on science, technology, education, things like that. The mass science school came along during that same time. And that progress has been rolled back.
So is the governor or the superintendent of education capable of stepping forward and taking control of this debate and moving the legislature towards a resolution?
Well, I don't know. At State Impact, you know, we have kind of an outsider's view on this issue, you know, where our focus is. But you hope so. I mean, you talk in this equation that you all are banning back and forth, the kind of losers in it are the kids here that are, you know, caught in the middle of all this. And you hope they're able to get this right, because when you look at other issues that the state faces, or, you know, big prison overcrowding problems, they can be linked directly back to these education issues. So
I think you'll see the person that has the best opportunity to fix it is probably the governor. I don't see it happening with the state superintendent.
All righty. Well, gentlemen, I'll tell you what. Our time has come to an end, so we shall adjourn sine die until February, when we take this up with a new legislature. Thank you all for coming in. Scott Carter from the Journal Record.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Sean Ashley from eCapital.
Great to be here.
Logan Layden from State Impact Oklahoma.
Anytime.
And I'm Keith Gaddy from the University of Oklahoma, and you've been listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU.